Welcome to this talk from the Canando Zen Meditation Center. Located in Mountain View, California, Canando's meditation practice is open to the public. For more information or to get in touch with us, you can visit our website at canando.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org.
Good evening, everyone. I think most of you know our speaker for tonight, Misha. She's one of the original members of Canando on College Avenue and one of the first people I ever met there. In fact, she taught me how to be Doan and taught me a lot about posture and sitting. Misha's the founder and the main teacher at Zen Heart Sangha, and she was ordained in 1998 by our teacher Les, and continues to be a very active member of our community as well. So please welcome Misha. Do you have a title for your talk tonight, Misha?
Guidelines for studying the way. It's very nice to see everybody, and thank you so much, Les, for inviting me and Teresa and Jayashree to be here this evening. And Diane really was one of my very first friends a long time ago. I started at Canando in 1984. It's kind of hard to believe that now. And I still remember the person who gave me Zazen instruction. I think each of us kind of remembers that person because that was always our first night. And for me, walking into the old Canando, it was magical. We've all said this at some time or another. It was like coming home. But for me, it was a shock because I didn't know I wasn't home. And so to walk in and have that feeling was, really, what does that mean? But I never looked back after that. And I was very fortunate because Les had been ordained by Suzuki Roshi as a teacher in a lay lineage, which allowed him to ordain me as a priest in a lay lineage. And now that doesn't seem so odd. There are many people doing it. But in 1988, when he ordained me, it was pretty odd. And even odder when he was ordained by Suzuki Roshi. I have to think that Suzuki Roshi had incredible vision to be able to see what was going to happen 40 years down the road. So as I said, the topic tonight, loosely speaking, is guidelines for studying the way, which is taken from the guidelines written by Dogen in 1233, I believe. But really, what I wanted to start with was acknowledging how crazy things have gotten. It is one of the more difficult times in the history of human civilization. And it's not to say that it's the worst time, and it's not to say that it's the only time. I'm sure people living in Hitler's Germany, that was pretty bad. And I'm sure if you were around when Caligula was a Caesar, that was pretty bad. But it does seem like it's one of those times when so much is happening. We've had 2 solid years of the pandemic, and we've just had an unprovoked attack on a peaceful nation, which is still going on, and civilians are dying, and children and mothers. And then, of course, just this last week, this attack on this elementary school with 19 people dead, 2 of them adults and the rest 10-year-old children. I'm sure that you're all as horrified and distressed as I am, but as someone who has dedicated her life to teaching young children of that age, it was particularly horrifying. I tried to imagine what any one of my former 10-year-olds would have done in the same situation and how terrified they would have been and how awful to have to live the rest of your life knowing that your teacher died for you or that your little classmate that you had known, you know, most of your young life is gone forever. And so I keep trying to think, you know, how are we to cope with all of this? What, you know, obviously we have our practice and thank goodness for that. But I was looking every now and then, I think of a new practice for myself that helps me go back to having a beginner's mind. And in this case, several months ago, I started going back to reading Dogen's very fundamental pieces in the Moon and a Dewdrop collection that Kaz Ta-Nehisi translated. And I'm sure that most of you here know who Dogen is, but I thought it would be useful to just remind us of a few things because the way he writes is directly affected by his life. His father was a minister in the imperial court, but he died when Dogen was only 3. And then his mother, who was also a member of an imperial family, died when he was 8. So by the age of 8, he was orphaned. And there's a very famous story of him at his mother's funeral, watching the incense that they've lit for his mother burning and having his realization that this is what life was like. Life is like a stick of incense that is burning up at all times, and it doesn't last long. And there's this little wisp of smoke that is the evidence of it. And it is all that's left at the end are ashes. So, of course, being orphaned at such an early age, I mean, he did have a couple of possibilities. Because his parents were both part of the imperial court, he could also have stayed in the imperial court and become some minor official. But because of his experience around his mother's death, he decided instead to devote himself to Buddhist practice. And at that time, the main Buddhist practice in Japan was called Tendai. And so he was ordained at the age of 14, which is pretty young by today's standards, but maybe not so much then, and practiced for quite a long time with his teacher there. But we know that his big question, you know, the Buddha's big question is, you know, why is there suffering? But Dogen's big question was, well, okay, after all these years of coming from India and China, you know, if all beings are already enlightened, why do all beings of past, present, and future arouse the wish for and seek enlightenment? In other words, and you've probably asked yourself this a few times, what need is there for practice if we're already perfect? You know, Suzuki Roshi famously said, apparently, that, oh yes, you are all perfect, but that doesn't mean there's not room for self-improvement. Well, what does that mean? So this was Dogen's big question. And he studied, you know, with all the great teachers of his time. But just like, you know, when the Buddha went around to all the sages in India asking his question, nobody really had a good enough answer for him. They tried, but they really didn't get what he was asking. And so he and his teacher, Myo Zen, decided to travel to Japan. Dogen was born in 1200, and at age 25, he and his teacher traveled to China to see if they could find one of the old Chan masters there who might able to shed some light on this. And in those days, traveling from Japan to China was a big deal. The Japanese, while they had boats, they always wanted to stay within sight of land. They were not like Vikings. They didn't travel out into the open ocean. And the sea between Japan and China is very rough. So it was a big deal to decide to go do this. So they went around to many temples, and eventually he came to the temple of Rujing, who in the Japanese lineage we know as Tendo Nyojo. And he was a Chan master of the Kaodong school of Zen. And again, famous story. He's sitting in the Zendo, and he hears the master lean down and say something to the monk next to him about body and mind drop away. And in that moment, he had a great understanding, and body and mind dropped away. But like all of those famous Zen stories, obviously there was a lot of work and preparation before that little thing dropped in, like the stone hitting the bamboo. So after 2 years with Tendo Nyojo, he received Dharma transmission, permission to teach, and he traveled back to Japan because now he felt that he could, in fact, train other monks and teach others what he had learned from his master. So when he first got back, he started on the really seminal teachings that we all know. Things like the Fukan Zazengi, which is basically instructions on how to sit, and the Genjo Koan, and the Bendoa, on the endeavor of the way. But he also wrote this series of wonderful instructions called Guidelines for Studying the Way. And in 1233, he began work on the enormous piece, the enormous body of his work that is still extant today, the Shobogenzo, the treasury of the true Dharma eye. And he is acknowledged as the founding father of Soto Zen, which is the Zen lineage we're in. So Dogen dies at the age of 50. In those days, not so unusual to die young. So what's amazing is that the Shobogenzo is like 60 volumes, and he wrote all of this in such a short period of time. But at 50, he's gone. And life goes on, and he's passed it on to his Dharma heir, who's passed it on to his. And we all know this from the lineage that when we read out loud the male ancestors, you know, we recite all those names in their order, right down to less. But in the meantime, in 1758, an incredible monk and poet is born. And his name is Ryokan. So remember, this all started because I was looking back at these seminal writings in Moon and a Dewdrop. And there was something in one of them, and there are all these annotations at the back. There's a glossary, and there are notes explaining a little bit about what is meant by some very odd phrase. I've been using this book for 30 years, and somehow I had always missed that there is a poem by Ryokan that's in between the last fascicle that Dogen wrote and the beginning of those notes. It's a beautiful poem. And I read it and I burst into tears, because especially there are two lines, which is really what I want to share with you tonight. So he writes this poem, remember, 500 years after the death of Dogen. I'm not going to read it all, but I'm going to read about half of it. So if you're interested, go find your moon in a dewdrop and look halfway to the back. On a somber spring evening around midnight, rain mixed with snow sprinkled on the bamboos in the garden. I wanted to ease my loneliness, but it was quite impossible. My hand reached behind me for the record of Ehe Dogen. Beneath the open window at my desk, I offered incense, lit a lamp, and quietly read. Body and mind dropping away is simply the upright truth. In 1,000 postures, 10,000 appearances, a dragon toys with a jewel. His understanding beyond conditioned patterns cleans up the current corruptions. The ancient great master style reflects the image of India. Now when I take the record of Ehe Dogen and examine it, the tone does not harmonize well with usual beliefs. Nobody has asked whether it is a jewel or a pebble. For 500 years, it has been covered in dust. Just because no one has had an eye for recognizing Dharma. For whom was all his eloquence expounded? Longing for ancient times and grieving for the present, my heart is exhausted. And it goes on from there. It's a very sweet ending, but you'll have to find it. So here we have Ryokan. It's 500 years later. He's feeling lonely. He was kind of a wandering hermit who happened to love children. And when he would go into villages, that would be the first thing he would do, would be sit down and play with the children in the street. But in the middle of the night, he can't sleep. He's lonely. He's feeling sad. And so he reaches for the writings of Dogen. And he's asking, between Dogen and myself, what relationship is there? And he says himself, he goes to Dogen because his understanding beyond conditioned patterns cleans up the current corruptions. The ancient great master style reflects the image of India, the wisdom of Shakyamuni. The current corruptions, I guess we're not the only ones. But what really caught my eye in all of this was that line, longing for ancient times and grieving for the present, my heart is exhausted. Everybody's hearts right now are exhausted. Between the pandemic, racial injustice, climate catastrophe, war, mass shootings, every time we look around now, it's overwhelming. And so we tend to think about, oh boy, in the good old days, longing for ancient times. And at the same thing, we are grieving for the present moment. It seems so hard. How are we to cope with all of this? Where are we to find solace? So there's another chapter in Moon and a Dewdrop called Only Buddha and Buddha. And it has this story which may provide a little insight. A teacher of old said, although the entire universe is nothing but the Dharma body of the self, you should not be hindered by the Dharma body. If you are hindered by the Dharma body, you will not be able to turn freely, no matter how hard you may try. But there should be a way to be free from hindrance. What then is the way for all people to be free from hindrance? So first we have to understand what is meant by the Dharma body. Because he says, although the entire universe is nothing but the Dharma body of the self, you should not be hindered by the Dharma body. Well, the Dharma body are the three bodies of Buddha. We recite these often. We have the Dharmakaya, which is the absolute aspect of truth. And then we have the Sambhogakaya. This is the enjoyment or bliss body that is the fruit of your practice. So if you are sitting in meditation, this is the Sambhogakaya. And then there's the Nirmanakaya, and that is the manifestation body that appears in the world. That's us, to benefit all beings. That's our bodhisattva vow. So even though everything in the universe is contained in these three bodies, this teacher of old is saying you should not be hindered by the Dharma body. In other words, yeah, you are hindered by it. And the proof of that for all of us is that we are suffering, that we are not feeling satisfied, that no matter what is going on, we have a problem with it. So what then, as the teacher says, is the way for all people to be free from hindrance? You know, it's one of the refuges that we take, you know, that we say, I, before all beings, I offer the way of being without hindrance. Is this a question that you have? Because I know it's one that I have. Is it even a realistic aspiration to be without hindrance? Is it possible? And I think that's a little bit what Dogen was asking. So Dogen goes on, remember, he says, understand that in the midst of awakening sentient beings, the Buddha Dharma is totally experienced. Explain it and actualize it this way. Know that it is the same with manifestation and having the Buddha body. So he is pointing to both that truth of Suzuki Roshi's when he said, looking at things as it is. That is the absolute truth of the Dharmakaya, things as it is. Not the way we want them, not the way we think they should be, but the way they actually are. And that each of us is then also waking up to the realization, the relative truth that is experienced through our own unique and individual being that is the Nirmanakaya. Both things are true. But it's pretty hard when we're in that being of the Nirmanakaya to experience the Dharmakaya of the absolute truth. So really what he's saying is that nirvana and samsara are all part of the same Dharma body. We are always going to experience the dissatisfaction of impermanence. The body changes, gets old, sometimes it gets sick. Things wear out. The first time I explained this to some young girls at my school who were like seventh graders, I talked to them about, well, think about the body as being like a car. If your parents have a brand new car, it doesn't have to go into the shop much, just gets a little tune-up. But if your parents have an old car, have you noticed they have to keep replacing things? Well, if we're lucky, the things that go wrong with us can be replaced or fixed. But sometimes they can't. Things wear out. So whatever is happening in this moment is going to change, and then there's the next moment. But in the moment of accepting that dissatisfaction, we can also experience the emptiness of it. Our complete interdependence with everything. You know, this is because of this, that, and on and on. And in that moment of acceptance, that is body and mind dropping away. That is ending suffering, at least in that moment. I think we have this idea that when the Buddha had his great enlightenment, that was it, he never suffered again. I don't think that's true. I think he understood deeply the nature of suffering in that moment, and he understood what could be done with it. But even after he had his great awakening, remember, he taught for another 50 years. And I'm sure he had some pretty disappointing times. I know for a fact that one time he tried to stop a war. And the first time he sat down in the middle of the battlefield, and both sides saw him sitting there and said, oh, and they backed off. But the second time he tried that, they said, sorry, not going to work this time. I'm sure that was disappointing, maybe even a little frustrating. Maybe he suffered a little bit, or maybe he understood, this is things as it is, and I have to step aside. So in the beginning, Shakyamuni laid down his understanding in the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path. But then Dogen takes that mantle up later and writes extensively in all those volumes of the Shobogenzo how to come to this understanding so that body and mind will drop away. Because there is the truth of dukkha, which is sometimes translated as suffering and sometimes as just dissatisfaction. You know, I want things to be a different way. And he very clearly states it is caused by desire, aversion, and ignorance. And the ignorance is of emptiness. The ignorance is of our complete connection to everything else, that there is no way that you or anything else in this world exists without everything else. Without the trees, you can't breathe. And without you, the trees can't. Without water, none of us would survive more than a week. Look at what's happening right now. Europe is about to really suffer from big food problem because of what's happening in Ukraine. And in this country, you know, it's kind of a joke now, I suppose, about this supply chain difficulty. But everything is now connected worldwide. It's all global. You have a virus in China, and the next thing, it's all over the world. How can we not understand how absolutely interconnected we are? We cannot keep acting as though we're individuals and we don't have to think about anybody else. It simply isn't true. And it's dangerous. So Dogen wrote about this. He wrote about this emptiness of permanent nature. He wrote about our connection to all things. And in the Moon and a Dewdrop, there are the guidelines for studying the way. And it's to encourage our practice. The very first section states, you should arouse the thought of enlightenment. Enlightenment gets a bad rap because, of course, we're not supposed to be being attached to any outcome. But enlightenment exists, just as ignorance exists. All enlightenment is bodhicitta, it's an awakened heart. And the very fact that you are all sitting here tonight, wherever you are sitting, tells me that you have already aroused that thought of enlightenment. So Nagarjuna, in his commentary on the Heart Sutra, wrote, "The mind that fully sees into the uncertain world of birth and death is called the thought of enlightenment." That's all. The mind that fully sees into the uncertain world of birth and death is called the thought of enlightenment. Zen has sort of a bad rap because a lot of people say, "Oh God, all you guys do is talk about death. You wear those black robes, so depressing." No, it's just the opposite. You cannot fully live your life until you have death right in front of you. This is what Dogen understood. His father dies when he's 3. His mother dies in front of him at 8 years old. He had a very early experience of death. And by the time you're my age, or even more, Les's age, you've had many friends die. And some of them very dear friends. And they are all still here. Because we never die. Because of our interconnection. You know, One of the people that is very close to me in my heart is my tea ceremony teacher, Peg. You know, I have become partly Peg, just as I am partly my mother and my father, who are also gone. We can't help it. They are passed down through us. Everyone we know. Everyone we know in our life becomes part of us. We carry them with us. We are never just something that we make up on our own. We are only ourselves along with everyone else. So Nagarjuna is also referring to the three marks of existence. The first one is about emptiness, about no permanent abiding self, no such thing. And it's also about impermanence. And it's also about suffering or dissatisfaction. So it's easy to explain impermanence to anyone. They don't have to be Buddhist. They don't have to be religious. You can just, you know, point to the body and say, "Is this what your body was like 5 years ago?" Nope. And I don't think many people would argue with you about suffering. They might argue with you about what you meant by it. Because often what they think you mean by it is, "Oh, you've just gotten to, you know, some terrible diagnosis of life-threatening disease," instead of the fact that, "Gee, I really wanted sorbet and all you've got is vanilla ice cream," right? Little tiny, tiny, tiny disappointment. It's still a kind of suffering. I've said this before, it's the distance between what actually is, things as it is, and the way you want them to be. That's the measure of your suffering. So I imagine for some of you, it's been a while since you've been at the Zendo, but maybe you remember, or maybe some of you have been there recently, but the wooden han, which we heard at the beginning, I loved that, by the way, has a wonderful reminder on it. The traditional phrase, it says, "Wake up. Life is transient, swiftly passing. Be aware of the great matter. Don't waste time." Be aware of the great matter. What is that? The uncertain world of birth and death. So I'm in the middle of it right now. A very dear friend of mine 10 years ago had a terrible stroke. She was paralyzed on one side for quite a while. It took months of work. She lived at a facility for 2 months, and she lived at one of the Sangha's homes for a couple months. We had to go into her house and fit it out so that she would be able to live there again. And then just last weekend, it's 10 years later, same weekend, by the way, Memorial weekend, she had another stroke. So I've been with her for the last 3 days. And she goes in and out because it's not the kind of stroke that is a clot. It's the kind that's a bleed. And fortunately, the tests have been coming back that the bleeding has stopped. But when there's that much blood in the brain, it takes a while and you are pretty disoriented until the blood has been dissipated. But this is somebody who I care deeply about. And I almost lost her 10 years ago. She was very close to death. She had the stroke while she was driving. And she lost control of the car. And fortunately, someone was able to avoid, you know, a major accident. But this time, really fortunately, she was with a couple of friends who called 911 immediately. They knew something was wrong. Maybe that's why she's doing a lot better, but still, these things happen to all of us. You know, we find out that someone we know has COVID. We find out that someone we know has cancer, or that they're getting old and losing their balance. I have a friend, a very old friend, old as in he's old, and he's got a problem with his inner ear and is getting less and less balanced. And apparently a few days ago he fell and had to have 20 stitches in his head. This is what happens to us. This is impermanence. If we're lucky. If we're not lucky, we die very early. We're in a car crash. We have a massive heart attack. One of my cousins this year requested one of those deaths that is allowed in Colorado because it was dying of ALS and it was getting impossible to take care of him. So these things happen to all of us. And that's just our personal life. That doesn't take into account those 17 children in Uvalde or the grocery store shoppers who were just out to get their groceries in New York, or all the women and children who were shot for no reason at all simply because they were in Ukraine in the wrong place. Life is transient. We don't know how long we have. And yet, it's like there's a part of us that doesn't take it seriously. It's like, oh, well, I've got plenty of time. No, you don't. You don't. You have to become aware of the great matter because it's coming. It's coming for you. It's coming for everyone you know. You know, as Thich Nhat Hanh says, you know, I am of the way to go old. I am of the way to be, you know, get sick. I am of the way to die. Everything I love is going to be taken from me. And the only thing that I will have left is going to be my actions. My actions are the ground upon which I stand. Our actions right now must be to find our peaceful heart here. We're not going to find it out there. The best way that we can cope, the best way I think that we can be there for others, to do our bodhisattva vows of saving all beings, so we must find that peaceful place in ourself. We must find the cause of our own hindrances. So there's a wonderful and very funny author named David Michie, The first book he wrote was The Dalai Lama's Cat. And all of these wonderful Dharma thoughts come through the mind and heart of a crippled, somewhat, Siamese cat. But you know, one of his latest books is called The Four Paws, P-A-W-S, of Spiritual Success. But I loved this piece and I want to leave this with you. If we wish to fulfill our true purpose, to experience ultimate well-being, we must let go of our preoccupation with ourselves. Bodhicitta, awakened heart. And if we wish to act in accordance with reality, we must let go of illusions about the way that things exist. Shunyata. The Buddha gave 84,000 teachings. But which ones are relevant to you or me? What particular mental obstacles do we have? I know for me, it's about anger and patience, that I'm working on anger all the time. You know, you can call it whatever you want, irritation, annoyance, frustration, exasperation, but it all comes under that category. And I work on this all the time because I know that is my main obstacle. Maybe yours is in the area of desire, greed, wanting what you want. Maybe yours is in the area of the ignorance of emptiness that you still don't quite see how connected everything is. We all spend a little time in all three poisons, but it's really helpful to be able to figure out which one you spend the most time in. And I'm in the second category, alas, of aversion. Each one of you here tonight has come for a different reason to practice. There are as many reasons to come to practice as there are practitioners. Some of you are monastics. Some of you are lay ordained. Some of you are very committed but not ordained. Some of you are new. But you all here, which means that there is a part of you that has, in fact, done the first step in the guidelines for studying the way. You have aroused the thought of enlightenment. There's a wonderful chapter in, I think it's in the second book by Suzuki Roshi, about letters from emptiness. And I believe that each of us here has received that letter. It's our true nature wanting us to jump into practice. And it calls out to us in every way possible, wake up, wake up, don't waste time. It's important to keep opening that letter. It's like a love letter that you set aside in a drawer and you wrap it with a beautiful ribbon and maybe you put a little perfume or cologne on it. And every now and then you take it out and you look at it again. Open the letter again. Investigate the great matter and the 84,000 teachings. What is relevant to you? What is going to help you recover moment after moment your beginner's mind? Rather than wallow in hopelessness or helplessness, which is sometimes how I feel about what's going on, Those letters are asking us to take our life seriously. Not to be serious, not to be pious, not to walk around with the long face, but to be serious about our practice, to take it into every moment, whether you're washing the dishes or washing your child, whether you're driving your car or you're working on your computer or listening to a Dharma talk, or having tea with a friend. Every single moment has the same value. And it is a great value. The best thing you can do to promote world peace and justice right now is to find that peace and justice in yourself. You don't have to pass it on. It happens naturally just by you being in the world. Francis.
Hi. I attended a talk by you many years ago where I remember it stuck that you said that even if you're an angry Buddha or a drunken Buddha, you're still a Buddha. And that simple statement you made has affected my life for at least 10 years. However, there are times that I realize that because I have a cat, and the cat is always present. I see him always present, always present. And I sort of lean back and forward between past and present. Occasionally, I catch myself and go back to present. But I seem to be doing this flitting about, which is also related to how the world is. And I remind myself that you said you're always a Buddha. And that brings me back. So I just wanted to thank you. That's it. And I also want to thank my cat.
I thank my cat all the time. And I noticed that Les's picture is Chelsea, I think. So we all love our cats and dogs. But, you know, it's interesting because we have this idea that a Buddha is this perfect person that never gets angry, that never gets cold, that never complains. And I think this comes back to Dogen's question, if we're perfect, why do we have to practice, right? Well, it's because there are different kinds of Buddhas, and you have all of them in you. But thank you for bringing that up, because I think we are very hard on ourselves sometimes. I try to remember that when I'm feeling angry, yes, I would like to not feel angry, because always the first person to suffer from that is me. But I also know that other people will suffer from it. And so to try and come back to that middle place without flip-flopping back and forth, I think is part of our practice. Thank you. Dave.
Thank you so much for your talk, Misha. It was beautiful. There's an amazing little book that I read a few years ago. It's called The Good Old Days. They were terrible.
Yep.
And I guess in a way, I'd like to sort of along that line, react to the three lines from the poem that you were talking about in a way that may be slightly different, and I'm just interested in your view of this. So if I remember them correctly, it's longing for the past, grieving for the present, my heart is exhausted. There seems to be a lot of longing for the past, especially longing for a past that never was in our world today. You know, make America great again. And what that means is make America different than it is, make it the way I want it. And I'm going to pretend that it was that way. Mm-hmm. It makes me feel like I can go back to it. And I'm just wondering if our goal is to engage in an authentic manner with every moment, that perhaps grieving for the present is reinforced by longing for the past and makes us feel like our heart is exhausted and we can't do anything in the present. So again, I mean, the good old days ain't what they used to be. Maybe that's just a delusion that reinforces our inability to engage with the present in an authentic way. And I'm just wondering what those three lines in the poem mean to you, and whether you think it's something different from what I just said.
Well, as I said, when I first read them, tears came into my eyes because everyone I know, particularly medical workers and educators, are really exhausted. COVID, you know, on top of everything else, COVID just really took everybody over the edge. But I'm with you. I think that the longing for ancient days is the way he puts it, but basically it's for the good old days, right? I think that is delusion, because you're absolutely right. They weren't good old days. I think grieving for the present, I think we have to grieve for the present before we can step forward into our lives. We have to acknowledge that there is grief. We have to acknowledge that it's a great sadness when we see people being killed for absolutely no reason, total innocence being killed. We have to allow sadness and grief, but we can't then allow it to go to the point of feeling hopeless or helpless. That's wallowing. And that actually isn't helpful. But then he says, you know, my heart is exhausted. I think even those of us who have been practicing for a long time, there's so many things to grieve that it starts feeling pretty exhausting. And so that is when we need to remember about the beauty and the joy in the world as well, because they exist too. We look in the eyes of our loved ones, realize that we have food on our plates, we have roofs over our heads, this beautiful room that I'm sitting in, that there are very simple, beautiful things in addition to all that other stuff. And that's where we have to find, we're not going to find it out there. We can't blame it all out there. You know, in every human being, there is such a mixture of good, bad, and indifferent, right? But we have to be continually trying to open our hearts, even in the midst of terrible things. That is what bodhicitta is all about. Awakened hearts, prying open that heart that is finding it hard to stay open because it's a muscle, right? We have to keep kind of pulling it apart, and every time we pull it a little further, it stays open a little bit longer, and before it kind of closes back, until finally it's easier to open it, even when people are, you know, not being kind. And I feel like right now, to remind ourselves in every moment when people are doing crazy stuff, open my heart, open my heart, open my heart. That's like my new mantra. So that's the part where he says our hearts are exhausted. My heart's tired of continually trying to open, but it is really the only thing that we can do. Thank you, Dave.
Thank you.
Teresa.
Hi, Misha.
Hi.
Thank you for your talk. There was so much in there. I look forward to hearing it again. I wanted to ask you, a friend of mine recently shared a poem that his father wrote about innocence. And I love the poem. It's a beautiful poem. At the end of the poem, he says something about innocence that reminded me of our practice. He said, well, it's written in Spanish, so, but he says something like, to finding every day that passes, that goes away and doesn't come back, always something new, always something beautiful. Mm-hmm. I thought, oh, that's really nice. But somehow your talk made me think about children and your experience with children, innocence and the innocence of children. I don't have a very elaborate question, but I wanted to ask you, how has it been for you to work with children, and how has informed your practice over the years?
How long have you got? it's funny. I feel so incredibly fortunate that I fell into being in the school where I was into education. It's not what my degree is in. And yet, you know, life just sort of puts you where you need to be. And I don't have children of my own, but I have 1,000 children, and they continue to contact me and write me and invite me to their big life events. And how has it impacted my practice? How has it impacted my life? I just feel so blessed. Because, I mean, yes, they're innocent, and at the same time, they can be capable of, you know, some crazy attitudes as well. But their absolute joy, the ability to go from, you know, some terrible thing that they're crying to 2 minutes later, they're fine. They really understand how to really stay in the moment. They have no training in that other than the way they were born. And the only sadness that I feel is that as they get older, that ability becomes less flexible. You see that it's harder for them to get out of their moods, as it were. But with the very little ones, you know, 1 second they can be crying and the next second they're laughing, and they are so in the moment. They are completely without prejudice, without unkindness. I mean, nobody is born that way. We are taught to do those things. And so, especially with the little nursery kids, it was always hilarious when they would come to the library because, you know, half the time they'd be coming in these crazy outfits that they'd gotten out of the costume box, and they didn't care whether it was for a girl or a boy or anybody in between. And there were times that I was shocked. A couple of them came with no clothes at all. And I was like, okay. It was only shocking to me as an adult. They didn't care. Didn't mean anything to them. So what it reminded me, always what they reminded me, was what's important. What's important always is our relationship and connection to each other and to everything, to the trees, to the stones, to the children, to our values, that children really get this. And it's something that we have to almost relearn. And so, and then the other piece of it is that when I arrived at my particular school, I saw what kind of a school it was, and it was right livelihood. You know, that we were supposed to, in the Eightfold Path, right speech, right action, right livelihood. And the moment I arrived, I thought, oh my goodness, this school is the living manifestation of the Eightfold Path. This is where it can happen. And was it easy? Not always. But I will tell you, it wasn't the children that made it difficult. It was the other adults. The children actually are always a joy. And now I've gone back and I've been a substitute a few times, and it's my happy place. So I don't know that I would be here doing any of this today without those 33 years at the school with those kids. They were all my Zen teachers. So I don't know if that answers your question, but I know it in my heart that that is, that they have been a serious practice for me. Thank you. So I know it's getting late. Is there any last person who would like to say something? Or Philip.
Hi, Misha. Thanks so much for your talk. Thanks for the bells and drums and the chant. And Misha, there's so many gems. I don't know. I'm just so appreciative of it. And I am, I guess, with all that's going on in the world, your last sharing about the best thing to promote peace is to have peace in yourself. That was, I didn't know that was what I needed to hear. So thank you.
You're welcome. And I wish you well, because that is one of the hardest things to do, actually. Is it's easy to think that the solution is out there someplace, and that, you know, this senator should do this, and this, you know, friend should do that. But actually, the only person that you could do anything about really is yourself. And that's where we have to start. So thank you all so much. It is really
Philip, did you want to? Philip had his hand up to share, and then somehow we missed.
I just wanted to thank you, Misha, for the wonderful talk. And one of the many things that it impressed me with is the huge amount, the panorama kind of resources of our tradition and our practice that is available for all the challenges that we face that in past and present and future. And there was something wonderful about the richness of all these different facets of the talk of referring to this practice, this insight. And it was wonderful. Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you. And thank you, Philip, for saying that, because it is a very rich practice. And we have, you know, the writings of the original texts from the Buddha and from Nagarjuna and from the Chinese Chan masters, and then to Dogen and then to Suzuki Roshi. You know, it's really quite amazing how much is there for us. And even though it's written in old-fashioned language and it was written, you know, centuries ago, we can still, you know, like that line in Ryokan, we can find something that is so beautiful and relevant to our experience right now. Mm-hmm. Our hearts are exhausted. And, you know, their hearts were exhausted back in the 1700s and back in the 1500s and back in the 1200s. And, it's a human problem. And thank you for pointing out that we are so fortunate to have so many resources. I feel like that's maybe part of the problem for many people, is that they have nowhere to turn. They don't have a practice that apparently supports them in the way that I feel supported by this. Thank you.
This talk was brought to you by the Canando Zen Meditation Center in Mountain View, California. For more information or to support this podcast, go to canando.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org.